You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the Midside, where we'd give up our voting rights for a 10% raise in rationality in the overall culture. Well, at least I probably would. I don't want to speak for everyone else on the panel. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you're as glad to have me back as I am that I am back, leave a 5-star review on iTunes saying how horrible the episode was without me. Actually, it was pretty good. I listened to it while I was in Europe, and I have to say, a commendable job was done without me. In fact, my girlfriend even mentioned how good of a host Daniel was, and I felt a little emasculated and a little threatened. So I'm sure you guys enjoyed the episode. And let's bring in a couple of those people. One who tried to replace me very valiantly, joining me this trip, Daniel T. Richards.
You better watch your back, man. I'm coming for that hosting spot, and I'm coming hard.
That was a little too personal. I don't need to know the way you come. Mm. Also joining me from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
Also coming for your host position, coming not quite as hard as Daniel, but still coming nonetheless.
I know I was in Europe for 2 weeks, but that doesn't mean we need to be overly and unnecessarily sexual now.
We
don't have to change the mores of this podcast.
Back into American culture.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the Benz. You're going to get the American Benz if we just jump right in. Like, I'm going to send you some croissants. And, although you weren't in that part of Europe. You weren't in the gay part of Europe.
I was in the manly part of Europe, so manly that some of them did not use deodorant or take showers.
You were in the Adam Carolla part of Europe. Yes.
Oh, I thought about that, and I was like, no, Adam, this is why you need to shower. Some of the public transit, specifically the Czech Republic, I had to Google this because at one point we were on a train, and we had a booth with the four of us. You know, you can sit down. And some guy came in, and he smelled so badly, I had to leave the booth because of that. And there were just other men in the Czech Republic, in Prague, smelled that when you walk by them. They just smelled like BO. So I had to Google it, and I'm sending my girlfriend all these articles while she's sitting there in that little booth with her parents and the guy, all about how they don't shower and how they use baths and men don't always use deodorant in the Czech Republic. So
I like it how she's reading about a phenomenon as she's just literally experiencing it. Like, she's getting it from every angle possible. Very educational cultural exchange.
Right. It was very mid-side because that's what we do, right? We witness the farce and we witness it in real time. Mid-side is a real thing, listeners. This is not just something I do once a week for all of you. This is how I experience life. I was also taunting her by letting her not, like, because if you keep focusing on the smell, it doesn't go away. So I was taunting her. But Daniel, I don't have too much of the American Benz. Because what I saw everywhere in Europe was there was always McDonald's, there was always Starbucks, and there was always Burger King. And there was Dunkin' in, I would say, 5 or 4 of the 7 cities I was in.
Dunkin' was in Europe?
Yeah, Dunkin' Donuts. I think there are more Dunkin' Donuts in Europe than there are in California.
That is sad. That is a sad state of affairs for you Californians. You are really missing out.
We are, but we're missing out on many things. And you know what I did miss and miss out on while I was in Europe? The farce of American culture. You know, we're going to find out. Well, I'm going to say some pretty bad stuff about Europe in the last segment here. But first, we need to delve into the farce that I missed while I was gone. So hopefully, Daniel, you can help me with this re-immersion process in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, just a fad.
They demanded change, but Parkland students say these school safety rules go too far. What are we talking about? Are we talking about metal detectors? Are we talking about drugs, gun-sniffing dogs searching lockers? Are we talking about random book bag checks? No, no, no. What we're talking about at Parkland High School is see-through backpacks. Yes, student activist Cameron Caskey went to school on Tuesday with a see-through backpack filled with tampons, an act of protest against the school's new clear bag policy. For him, yes, Cameron is a him, and dozens of his classmates at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the new rule requiring students to carry their belongings in clear backpacks is a violation of privacy. Period. You like that? You like how the writer took the tampons and they made it into a joke by putting comma period after?
I enjoy that you had to distance yourself from that to make sure nobody thought you were adding that in as commentary.
I always want to point out that journalism has become total garbage. That is my goal in life. So, since the rule went into effect on Monday, almost 2 months after a former student sneaked an AR-15 onto campus. Sneaked? Okay. Students have complained
that's actually proper grammar.
Unnecessary and intrusive. Caskey says, unless they're bulletproof, I don't feel much safer. Justin, there are a lot of different angles.
Bulletproof backpacks.
On this story. But I'm curious, do clear backpacks violate your Fourth Amendment rights?
Well, if they do, then anytime anyone goes to an NFL game, it's unlawful search and seizure. Now, that's a private industry, though. You're talking about public schools, right?
Indeed, I assume this is a public school.
Right. I mean, I can't answer that. Why are you asking me the question that's more for you to answer? Is this just your way of being able to answer first? Like, you got addicted to it when I was gone, so you're trying to, like, subversively ask it to throw it back to you? Is that why?
No, I'm just trying to make sure that your brain is engaged here for the first episode of The News with Daniel T. Richards since your return. You got to be thinking. Got to be on your feet. It's not Europe. Can't be sloppy. No lazy thinking here in the mid-side.
Well, that's very true, what you're saying about sloppy thinking in Europe. But no, I have a couple of things to say about this that are not a Daniel T. Richards-oriented thought, which is, what is the constitutional ramifications of this? These are more Justin thought. This is what you all missed last episode. So I have two things to say about this. The first thing is, I mean, I had three, but you already had me burn my NFL, because in NFL games, you have to have clear bags now.
Yes.
So that was my first one. My second one is, were clear backpacks like a fashion accessory from Claire's in the 90s? Or was it Lisa Frank or something that like clear backpacks were all the rage?
Is Lisa Frank the overly colorful trapper keeper?
Yeah, I think so.
Memories.
From the
I remember back when I was in fifth grade or something, more like seventh. They were actually proposing this, not at my school. I went to private school, but like at public schools, they were actually proposing clear backpacks as a means of making the school safer. This idea has been around for a while.
Well, of course it has. It's a logical sort of thing, right? Like, I don't know if it would work or not. I'm not trying to advocate it or anything, but it's logical. It's like you want to make sure.
One of the more obvious things you can do.
It's like metal detectors and policemen and arming the teachers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. That's where I was going.
So a couple other things now that I'm thinking of it. The farce angle of this is twofold, and those are the couple other things. One is, how does a guy carrying a clear backpack with tampons in it protest this? Like, what? I don't understand.
I mean, if you look at how many tampons were in his backpack, it was protesting. I mean, the sheer volume of tampons he stuffed into this bag is just, it is unfathomable about the amount of flow he's prepared to deal with.
But here's the thing, James. I get what you're saying, that he would never do that on a normal day. Cause first of all, he's male. Second of all, can you even sell that many tampons at school? Like, I mean, I guess if all the girls' cycles synced up, maybe you could.
Sell?
But
you think he's selling them?
I'm building to a point here. I'm building to a point here. I think we in America have forgotten how to protest. Because how do you get from that dude is a weirdo carrying a clear backpack with tampons in it to protesting? Like, I would never think, like, oh, that dude's upset about possibly having clear backpacks. Like, it's not the most effective way to protest what he's protesting. The most effective way to protest is find out a way to smuggle something in still in the clear backpack and intentionally get caught. Like, that, carrying a bag full of tampons does nothing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it makes you look like a... Never mind.
Right. It's now, here's my final thing.
It occurs to me as very postmodern.
Correct.
It's 100%. Of, was it UT Austin where the students brought...
dildos instead of guns.
Thank you. To school.
Yeah.
And protesting a gun open carry law or whatever it was on campus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much. But that's all of this sidesteps the point of how farcical this is and how American this is. This is so American, where it's, I want all of these laws to infringe on everyone else until they affect me. Then fuck you, I don't want these laws anymore. That's 100% what this is.
To put the hypocrisy very clearly, not a big thing we talk about here, but it's funny in this case. Clear backpacks violate my right to privacy. Also, we should ban guns. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting methodology of not thinking is what it is. And it's perfectly illustrative of how terrible these schools are and why we should weep for our future. Because these are the thinkers of tomorrow. These are the great intellectuals who will lead us into the new era. Children
tomorrow?
Are the future.
I thought they were today. I mean, that's the thing. Like, aren't we being led to believe that anyone over the age of 25 can't have an opinion anymore? Isn't that what social media has driven us to?
I don't know if it's over 25, but certainly this is how I view it and how I think the media is portraying it. Whoever has the most emotional response in the moment is correct. And right now, the youngins are having the most emotional response, and therefore their opinion is more important than everyone else's.
James, I believe he just teed that one up for you.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a complete lack of any kind of direct interface with the issues. And there's actually one quote I can take from this to show not necessarily the emotionalism. The emotionalism is what leads to this, but you can see that, like, there's no thought about how is it we should approach this issue. Like, you know, how should we frame the issue? There's no thought whatsoever there. And here's evidence of that. Quote, the student leaders of Majority Stoneman Douglas have been demanding change. Okay, so first of all, I wasn't even planning this one, but first of all, just demanding change. Namely, tighter gun laws, so specific change, since their classmates and mentors were slaughtered in February. But newly enacted school safety policies aimed at preventing any more school shootings, they argue, go too far without going far enough. So think of that sort of unquote. So think of that way of thinking. It's like, okay, it goes too far without going far enough. How are you framing the issue when saying it that way indicates that you're not framing the issue in any kind of actual absolutes. It's just like, oh, well, we can go this far or that far. Those are our options, as opposed to, like, okay, well, what sort of measures can we take to prevent this? And what sort of principled considerations can we bring to the table, like, to, you know, maintain rights, namely privacy and perhaps even the Second Amendment, while also enhancing our safety? It's not thought of that way. It's either we go more or we go less. And this was, And since that's a stupid way to think about it, they're forced to say this retarded sentence of it goes too far without going far enough. It was A and it was also not A.
Oh, man. It just goes to show, I think, that our schools, specifically this school, but I see it in a lot of high schools, are not setting up children to be critical thinkers in any way. They're setting them up to be political activists. Specifically political activists for what we used to call communism, by the way, and we stopped calling it communism. James, you might have to enlighten us as to why we stopped calling it communism. But basically, they're set up
because
to
little... I can answer that one.
Okay.
Because communism was terrible And I can answer that because, yeah, go to where communism was.
I can answer that because I have fucking eyes.
And so we're doing a huge disservice to these young people because we're not teaching them to think, we're teaching them to regurgitate. And you know what we're really good at teaching them is pivoting, which is, I have presented a flaw in your argument or your principle, so instead of addressing that flaw, you basically pivot to whatever your point is. So they become master activists. Saul Alinsky would be just overjoyed at how well the school system has made these children young little warriors in the fight against capitalism. And in fact, if he was still alive, I would name him Secretary of Education because there's no one better to oversee the school system than him. He would just be thrilled.
God.
This is the Daniel is emo edition about everything, just so you know.
And incidentally, just something from my own experience that relates to this is I have a student who's a very serious student of math, and I've tutored him from, I think I may have mentioned him on the show before. I started with him at eighth grade when he was in Algebra 1, and now he's 16 and he's on differential equations, which is essentially calculus level 4.
Nice.
Think of it that way. And he knows, as a junior in high school, he knows about as much physics as I knew when I was a junior in college. So very, and this is all from me and self-teaching. This is from James education and self-education. And
do you have like a program you want to plug right now, like where people can find you for math education? That was a really good self-advertisement.
I'm making a video series on the YouTube channel Radical Mathematics, so if you want to know the general method by which I have an actual YouTube channel for it. I might as well plug it with that.
I was trying to help you make money and you're plugging a YouTube channel. Come on.
I like it. Finish the point, James.
What's the
channel?
Radical Mathematics.
Awesome. Is there a URL for it, or do they just search? If they search Radical Mathematics, they're
just
not going to find
just
out
search
like
Radical Math.
Yeah, that's what I worry about. If they search Radical Mathematics, they're not going to find out like 5 Nazis is equivalent to 1 regular human life. So you can kill 4 Nazis and it's okay.
Don't put it in YouPorn or something. Like, go to Google.
Yeah, go to YouTube and search Radical Mathematics.
If you search
Radical
Mathematics on YouPorn, do you find out how many dicks it takes to make a gangbang?
Anyway, he hates school. Anyway, moving past that, my student, he's super bored in school. He told me I was putting in 2% effort and got all A's. But then just to see what would happen, I put in 1% effort instead, and I still got all A's. So he's just bored as hell in high school. And it just makes me wonder, like, man, a lot of kids who are like him, who don't have some kind of actual education on the side like my student does, they become nihilists. I understand now why so many math and science people become nihilists, is because, like, they're serious about education. They're smart in these sort of quantitative ways. And then they're just not given an outlet for that creative work. So they just decide that there's nothing worth living for.
That's why so many
of these people are nihilists.
He's not a robot? How do you know? Like, how do you go from 2% to 1% effort? Like, do you just like switch a dial?
Yeah, he's got a little dial on his forehead that I adjust periodically.
Yeah, fine tuning. I think if I hadn't discovered Ayn Rand in college, I would have become a nihilist because I was so disenfranchised. I was so thoroughly bummed out by the state of education when I got to college because my high school experience was so terrible that I had this sort of high hope that college would be the place that I would actually learn something.
And, oh, yeah, me too.
And I just got there, and I was so bummed out.
James, please do not say
semester.
Those words. You as a male cannot say me too. Please apologize.
Right. Also, you can't just say me too
anyway.
Anymore, James. You have to say hashtag me too, just to be very clear.
Right. Okay, yeah. Only then is it gender appropriation.
And I just, like, if I hadn't discovered Ayn Rand, and I hadn't discovered reason, purpose, and self-esteem, I would have been a nihilist. I don't think there would be any way around it. It's almost inescapable. If you're ambitious and you want an education, you go into this system that is total trash.
Yeah, yeah. And I've told him, like, you know, I kind of girded him against that. I said, if you go to college, I can't guarantee you it's going to be much better than what you're experiencing now. Because by the time you end up in college, you'll already have the equivalent knowledge of someone who has a BS in physics. So, like, it may just be more of the same. Yet he still has to go through all these damn classes to get the credentialing. Well, so, you know, we're actually thinking about an alternate route for him to go other than college.
Good, because if you go to college, you'll get to come up with studies like this. New study suggests that fake news might have helped Donald Trump win the 2016 election. Oy vey. Okay. President Trump has repeatedly said that Russian interference didn't matter in the 2016 presidential election, and he has suggested, wrongly, that the intelligence and law enforcement communities have said the same. His overriding fears seem to be that Russian interference and the fake news it promoted would undermine the legitimacy of his election win. Trump won't like this new study one bit. Okay, pause.
Trump supporters hate him.
Can I just mourn, just weep for journalism? Just weep. This isn't an opinion piece in the Washington Post. This is new. This is reporting. This is an article in the news section. Okay, moving on. The study from researchers at Ohio State University finds that fake news probably played a significant role in depressing Hillary Clinton's support on Election Day. The study, which has not been peer-reviewed, just let that sink in for a moment, but which may be the first look at how fake news affected voter choices, suggests that about 4% of President Barack Obama's 2016 supporters were dissuaded from voting for Clinton in 2016 by belief in fake news stories. There's a lot more information in here, Justin, but first I want to ask you, how much of a gaslighting is this story? Like, on a scale of 7 to 10. Like, let's forget anything below a 7.
I mean, I think this is the old Backdraft experience at Universal Studios. I think that's how much this is gaslighting.
That is a fantastic reference that all of me and James will get, I think, maybe.
No, I think our demographic skews a little bit older than us. That's why I'm assuming people will get that joke. But for anyone younger than us, Backdraft was a movie where Kurt Russell played a firefighter, and they actually had the set on the Universal Studios lot. So when you went to the theme park, one of the things you could do is go, and they would recreate the special effects from the big climactic fire, and you could feel the fire on your face.
Yeah, that is some
gaslighting. This is a joke, because fake news has helped every president ever win elections. Like, okay, I'm being over the top by saying every president ever, but I've said this over and over again, and I will continue to say this. People act like fake news is a new thing, and they act like it's this term Trump came up with. No, all Trump winning did was expose the bias of the media. And now fake news is trying to be turned around and spun to this idea that it's something the right uses. Like, Fox News is the only creator of fake news, and they're the ones who got Trump elected. No, everyone thought Trump was going to lose. That's the biggest fake news of all. And that's the thing, is the gaslighting is using this term to distract from the fact that you're the one creating fake news. You're creating fake news when you're saying Trump will not like this study one bit. Trump's not going to find out about this study. He's watching Roseanne, dude.
Yes, but James, they used a regression analysis, so it must be true.
I know, dude. We took the science and we plugged it into the math, and then it gave us the statistics, and we used those statistics to produce more science. Thus, you have to believe it, or you're basically one of those people who deny evolution.
Oh my God, the science.
And global
reporting.
Warming. Don't forget about it. Don't forget. If you don't agree with the science,
God
you
forbid,
are a global
yeah.
warming denier.
Denier.
Yeah. Sometime I'm gonna if there was one room with all of these sorts of scientists in it, which are like a lot of them, and then some of the better scientists are unknowingly kind of a party to this, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, not a bad guy, but he promotes this idea of faith in science. There's like, we have to trust in science. It's like, well, no, you have to trust in the evidence, not what scientists say. You have to trust in the evidence. That's what you need. But we don't understand the evidence for a lot of these scientific theories being put forward. So we shouldn't just believe them, because then we'd be having faith in them. Yeah. I want to go to a room with all the Neil deGrasse Tysons in it and just say, I'm going to end this shit once and for all. And then careful. Walk out of the room.
Careful. Careful.
What?
You're going to go to a room full of the Al-Qaeda route there for a moment.
Yeah, I was going to say a room full of people, and you're telling them you're going to end it for once and all.
No, I was making, God damn it. And then I'd walk out. I don't know. Fuck it. I was trying to do a thing. Just let's move on.
I want to return to the gaslighting, though, Daniel, and maybe this will lead to your point and build to this point. But this has gotten to the point of coping. They have not moved past denial. And this is what people in denial do.
Oh my God, that's so true.
They blame it on other people. Oh my God, Hillary couldn't have lost because there are people who legitimately like Trump and legitimately have reasons for voting for Trump. And that's why she lost. It has to be some stupid. First it was the Russians. Now it's fake news. And next it's going to be Stormy Daniels. Like, who can we blame for Trump? And in order to blame something for Trump, they have to convince you that your perception of reality is wrong. Specifically, anyone who voted for Trump, they're trying to tell them their perception of reality is wrong. And then anyone who can see the flaws in Hillary Clinton, they're trying to convince that their view of reality is wrong. All because of their denial, because they don't want to look inward and see what's wrong with their point of view.
Yeah. You know, it's particularly bad when Hillary Clinton, in an interview in India, says that all the women who voted for Trump were basically just doing what their husbands told them to do. What level of denial do you have to be in to say that out loud? You can believe that. That is a certain level of denial, but to say it to someone else, to an audience of someone else's, to a room where you are being recorded, and that recording will travel around the world. That is a level of denial that is hard for me to fathom, how disconnected from the world you actually are.
It's yes, really and incredible. That foreshadowing, that will lead to a story of one of my experiences in Europe, but to connect it back to Hillary right now, this is what happened when she called people deplorable. She was like, oh, there are so few people who don't believe what I believe that I can call anyone who doesn't deplorable. And then they were like, well, fuck that. Like, we're not as extreme as you are, Hillary. And they either took that word and used it as a self-label or just silently went and voted as their husbands told them to.
That's right.
Speaking of the rationalizing and just sort of the open air therapy session that this article constitutes, I actually didn't exactly know what I was doing, but that is exactly the tone with which I read this entire article. Like, something made me think, like, I'm going to read this article from a certain perspective. I'm going to read it as though it's coming from the mouth of someone who doesn't want who's like a trauma victim who does not want to admit that the bad thing happened. Like, say someone who got raped and they're in denial about, like, well, it wasn't really, you know, unconsensual, you know, something like that. Yeah. You know, I read it from that perspective. And the language checks out entirely. It completely goes with that way of reading it. And Justin kind of put words to how it was, like, I was reading the article as though it was coming from the mouth of someone who just couldn't take it.
Just, and I want to just be clear about Russians. Something you said, James. You said the trauma victim. Their candidate not winning the election is not trauma. I want to be clear about that.
Of course
these
not,
are people
but
who know.
They're treating it that way, though.
Right, and that's what I want to be clear about. They're treating it that way because they have suffered some other trauma, which has put them in this inability to cope mindset. that's how they cope with the world because they've never dealt with their other trauma. And this is just a manifestation of that coming forward. And maybe that's too much psychologizing for you guys out there, but that's what's going on here.
It is really incredible to just to talk about the claim on its face here for a moment, because despite their regression analyses, it doesn't take but simple sort of argumentation to think about, I don't know, other confounding factors that you might have looked at. For instance, how terrible the candidate was compared to other candidates, her unfavorability rating among Democrats, for instance. Or how about, as Justin alluded to, the fact that the Washington Post reported that Trump had an exactly 0% chance to win the day before the election. Did that dissuade Trump voters from going out to vote for Trump? Would, in fact, if the media had had an accurate representation of the candidates, would it have been a landslide for Donald Trump? How many people were dissuaded by the fact that the New York Times said they had less than a 1% chance? Or all the, you know, the various reports about his shenanigans and whatnot.
Or to flip that on its head, Daniel, how many people didn't vote for Hillary because they thought she had it in the bag? Oh, I'm not going to go in the fucking line with all those people and waste my time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That is one of the scariest things about running a popular, quote unquote popular candidate is it's the Carter effect, because Carter in the Reagan campaign was shown to be dominating when Reagan was running against him in the first term, and a lot of his voters basically thought Carter had it in the bag and didn't show up. So it's interesting. Anyway,
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you think the aspect of this that the left can't face is the fact that Trump won or the fact that their candidate lost? Which aspect do you think is the part they can't countenance?
False dichotomy, bro. And what I mean by the reason I'm saying that is not only can they not believe Hillary lost, but they can't believe Hillary lost to Trump. You know, if Hillary had lost to like Mitt Romney, they'd be like, oh, okay, whatever. Like this Massachusetts Republican who's not really like anything extreme. But they built Trump into this villain that he isn't. And what I mean by that is not that he's not like crazy, like, you know, as I've said, a narcissist who just is unhinged and says whatever the fuck he feels like and fires people on Twitter. But they made him into this racist Nazi. And the fact that Hillary lost to that, they don't have a proper perception of Trump. So she lost to somebody they think is a racist Nazi. So that's, it compounds it. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now stack on top of that the fact that a lot of them are probably, or at least there's a tendency towards being a social metaphysician, someone who believes that basically like reality is what the majority thinks it is.
Yeah.
And now they're in this state where their stand-in, their pinch hitter for reality being other people, they can't stand the idea that other people or a majority of other people voted for the other candidate. That's like the equivalent of opening your eyes and realizing that like three of your friends were just hallucinations the entire time. Like, oh my God, like, am I perceiving reality properly? Like, if I believe in Hillary and so many people believe in Trump, does that mean I've lost contact with reality? Like it's the equivalent of that for them, maybe. And that's
I'm laughing right now because you're basically saying, James, that the democratic approach to politics in the world is Tinkerbell. That if you clap and believe hard enough, she gets her wings. That's what you're saying right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, what else is new is all I can say.
It's kind of.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what I was saying about the deplorable thing, James, what you just said. They believed that everyone who was against them was a racist Nazi and was deplorable. So it's okay to just label them that because that's such a minority. They don't believe that anyone can rationally disagree with them.
Yeah. And to play ombudsman for a second, a majority of people did vote for Hillary Clinton, to be clear. Trump won the the Electoral College. And then two,
Daniel, that's a subtlety that will be entirely lost, I think, on this kind of mentality.
Absolutely. Totally. Unequivocally. But we try to be factual here. We're not, right. But we try. And two is, it's sort of like the person who makes a mistake but doesn't have the self-esteem, or maybe it's not even self-esteem, the wherewithal? No. Let's go with self-esteem. To, like, admit that they made a mistake.
It's self-esteem. And, I know what you're going to say. It's self-esteem.
Be able to correct it. And so instead of basically saying, you know, it's not the end of the world that this guy got elected, they have to double down, right? They don't have the ability to reflect and say, yeah, we labeled him the next Hitler, but, you know, he's the opponent. He won. We'll get him next time. They have to double down because it would basically destroy them in order to have to admit that that they weren't right. It would destroy them psychologically to have to admit that that they created a straw man of someone, that they essentially lied, and they can't do it. It's not possible.
That was your greatest point ever, Daniel. I enjoy the fact that you are now psychologizing.
When in Rome,
God. I mean, I don't know, like, it may be psychologizing, but this, none of this shit makes sense unless you view it from some angle of this kind. You can't, it just, the pieces don't fit together unless you, I don't know, kind of bring it together this way.
Yes!
Screw it, let's psychologize everyone. Yes! Including the 33% of Americans.
Apparently, I'm sorry, go on.
Who would forfeit their voting rights for a 10% pay raise. Yes, this comes from Time.com's money section. Apparently, there was a survey conducted by LendEDU, an online student loan marketplace, that polled a little over 1,200 working Americans and basically asked them a variety of questions about a hypothetical pay bump of 10%, and then asking them about various things that they would give up. And the results are shocking, or whatever they are. So 35% of employees said they would sacrifice their voting rights for life for a 10% pay increase. Just over 9% of respondents said they would give up their children's right to vote for the 10%. More than 12% said they would break up with their partners. 19% said they would give up health insurance. And 40% would forfeit their dental care for 5 years for a 10% raise. Nearly 18%
madness
would say goodbye to their Social Security benefits, which is interesting. Well, millennials, considering that they won't be there in 30 years, 40 years, whatever. Makes sense?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. We've already said goodbye to those.
That's right. So we don't need to get into all the various things, but the main one here, and the one that's making headlines, is that a third of Americans would give up their voting rights for a 10% pay raise. And of course, the article sort of editorializes in its second sentence saying, pause for a second to let that sink in. So Justin, what does this really say about people? Because the article is trying to make it out like people are dumb. Is that what you get from the article?
No, I get that one third of this country is not beyond hope. We can take that one third and build upon that base and return this country to rationality. That's what I get from this article.
Yeah, let me.
We should make it great again.
Let me make an actual bargain here. Oh,
sorry. Go ahead, James.
I intentionally did not use those words.
Here. Yeah.
You didn't intentionally use what word? Sorry.
I sidestepped saying we can make America great again because I didn't want to be linked to that. But go ahead. What's the actual bargain, James? What's the actual bargain?
So, yeah, the actual bargain I will make with reality, not this hypothetical one for the pay raise, is this. I will sacrifice my voting rights for the rest of my life. And in return, I will get the amount of time on each day I would have spent voting. And I will, and that time I will instead commit to working, doing fun things, and maybe sleeping. And I will make that bargain here and now.
Nice.
Cause I just don't think when this story actually made me realize, like, wait a second, am I going to vote again? And I'm like, yeah, fuck, probably not. Justin, when's the last time you voted?
The election before this election. So what year was this election?
So you voted for,
what was this election?
So what, you voted for Romney?
Is that the one before? What year was that?
Yeah, so that was, I so think this was 16 before that was 12.
Yeah, so I voted in 12. Yes, I voted for Romney. Thanks for exposing me on here. No, I voted for Romney, and Daniel and I sat in Barney's Beanery and heard the results, right, Daniel?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I didn't vote in this election. I'm glad. James, I love how over the past year of this podcast, it's subtly you moving towards acting like me. Where, like, you had the response I had to the Trump election where you're like, fuck, it's all crazy emotionalism and nobody knows what they're talking about. And now you're like me where you're like, I'm never going to vote again. But I do think that's partly because we're in California. And what I mean by that is I remember voting when I was in Clemson and I walked into the library and there was nobody there. And I could, like, sit there for 10 minutes and read everything and properly understand it and vote and then walk out and there's still nobody there because they have enough voting places and there's not a shitload of people. But here in California, the infrastructure sucks so much and there's such an amount of people that you have to stand in line for 90 minutes to vote.
Yeah.
I don't know. Last time I voted, I stood in line for about 10 minutes.
That's still too much.
It's still too much. Yeah, maybe it was worth it last time I did it. I mean, no, it definitely wasn't because I fucking voted for Gary Johnson. But I mean, oh, I actually get my ballot mailed to me now. But still, like, mailing it, like, I don't know, that takes me a good, I have to read every single one of the cockamamie ballot proposals and then only to find out that I'm just going to vote no on every single one of them every single time. And then I even vote no on some of the people like who have already been elected. It's just like, hey, this person's going to be a judge. Like, is that OK with you? I just say no, just on principle, because I'm like, they're probably a douchebag. So I'm just going to say no to all of them because I don't know them. All I know is that they wanted to be in public service. So probably no. And I just put no on all of them. And then
the
it's
Fred
like,
McGruff,
you know,
approach to voting. No, that's yeah, a take a bite out of crime. Like, Who's just say no? Smokey yeah. the Bear? No, Nancy Basically, Reagan. The Nancy Reagan approach to voting. Just say no.
That's right.
I love how I just made Nancy Reagan the same as Fred McGruff and Smokey the Bear.
In the last election, I also voted for Gary
Johnson.
Daniel,
do you plan on voting?
And that will probably be the last time I vote. I don't know. I like the concept of a protest vote. I know it's kind of worthless, but it makes me feel good. I don't know. Maybe I'll get drunk and vote. Huh. Maybe that's how I'll handle it. I'll make it like a party. I'll hand out shots outside the polling place. You know.
At this point, I want it to be like the census where everyone puts their Jedi. Who can we all vote for?
Well, I sort of already do that in the sense that so Virginia lets you write in candidates. The only candidate I voted for on the ballot in the last election was Gary Johnson. Every other candidate I wrote in either myself or my wife. Including
that's what I mean.
I thought, well, you don't live in our district, otherwise your name would be on there too. I thought Faiza had a really good chance at like.
I didn't say what about me. I said that's what I mean, asshole.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I just assumed you're a narcissist, so I heard what about me?
Jesus.
So this is my thinking about this story overall, and it's sort of similar to Justin's, which is it's actually a positive sign to me that a third of people have decided that a 10% increase in their pay, certainly over their life, is a far greater value than electing anyone. And part of this is, this properly speaking, our system is not a democracy. I don't want 100% participation. I'd like a lot less participation than there is, in fact. Whenever people bemoan the number of people who vote, it's only like 30% or whatever actually vote who can. I think way too high. That's my first thought. Way too many people voting. We need far fewer people voting who know what they're talking about, who read the issues, who understand politics, who understand the proper role of a government, and who will only vote for things that enhance individual rights. If we can limit the voters to those people, that would be awesome. Thank you. And I would get
rid
of everyone.
So are you saying like only property owners should vote? Is that what you're saying?
Didn't that come through? White male property owners? That's what I said.
That's the joke I'm making. That's the joke I'm making. Yeah.
No, but like,
no, Daniel,
if you limit it to something,
what you're saying.
If you limit it to something like that, something where you had to have a steak or something in order to vote, and I don't mean like a porterhouse.
So only vampire slayers can vote? That's what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. Only
if
Chef
you're a vegetarian,
Jeff
you can't vote.
No, here's the problem with what you're saying, Daniel.
Only that
Lowry
guy can vote.
I agree with what you mean.
Yeah.
But if you take the one third of people who would not vote and take the 10% raise, that would make the voting results worse because you've taken all the rational people out of the voting pool.
Well, I want to up the I want it to be a 200% increase in your salary to not vote. I want everyone to not vote. I want a group of about 1,000 people to vote, and that's about it.
But if you give a 200% raise to the people who make nothing, they're still going to vote.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not a democracy person. Democracy sucks. It's given us nothing but crap over the years. Prove me wrong. Or what's that
Europe?
Meme? Change my mind. Yeah.
Europe?
No, you're proving me right. Thank you.
European. But I'm
European.
What's that stupid joke? If you're Italian in the kitchen.
No, I'm a pooping.
Venezuelan in the bedroom. Moroccan in the living room. What are you in the bathroom? European. Okay.
Oh, wow, your dad jokes are turned up to 11.
How I am working so hard
now?
On it.
How many butts are we weigh? Four?
That's right. Three and a half. Yeah, so, man who was raised by wolves in a cave admits he's disappointed with human life. This is woke, folks. This is woke. Okay. Marcos Rodriguez Pantoja was dubbed the Mowgli of Spain when he was found by authorities, but the former wolf boy says he struggles with the coldness of the human world and wishes he could go back to living with the animals. He told the BBC, "I didn't know where to go. I just escaped to the mountains." He was basically 7 years old when he started living with wolves and had been living with them for about 12 years when they found him at the age of 19. Now he's 72 years old, lives in a small, cold house, and says his last happy memories are his childhood with the animals. He says, for instance, that people laugh at him because he doesn't know about politics and football. So there's that. And he doesn't like the hustle-bustle of life, but unfortunately can't return to the animals because he wears cologne now. I wish I was making all this up. Unfortunately, I'm not.
Can he just, what? Like, just stop wearing...
Don't, all right, never mind. Don't ruin it, James. Don't ruin it for us. Okay. Justin, better to live with the wolves or better to talk about politics and soccer?
Yeah, that's such a tough question.
God.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Like, I want to agree with this guy because human beings suck. Okay? If there's one thing I've learned over the past 2 weeks, it's that human beings are terrible. But at the same time, this guy's fucking batshit insane. And what I mean by that is he's literally insane. Like, this is a guy who went through intense trauma as a kid, never learned to deal with it, which only made it harder for him to interact with people, which turned him into an embittered 72-year-old man. Like, there was nothing about this story that anyone should take for anything. I forgot the word I was going to say. Take for anything. This should just be like, why is this news? Why is this news? That's the question. Why
Even
is this
better,
news?
By the way, the call-out section at the end of this story called Other People Who Have Been Raised by Animals. God, I love journalism. And there's sections for raised by monkeys, raised by goats, raised by cats, raised by wild dogs. So, just in case you were curious.
I'm more curious as how these people are raised. I mean, there's two things, right? There's the one, though, they're not really raised, right? Because you can't be raised as a human being by animals who are not human beings. But the second thing is, how does this happen in reality? Like, how do you just go to the mountains and live with wolves? Like, are the wolves just like, oh yeah, we're just going to bring food to this human? Like, something does not add up to me.
It is a little strange, but...
I mean, this happens. You get, you know, if you get these poor children who get mixed in with a social pack animal, and then they end up receiving a kind of primitive education from the social environment of an animal pack, and they behave like the animal. Like, I saw this one girl who would behave like a wolf because she was raised like wolves. Like, she would bark, she would, like, you know, sniff your ass, I guess, probably, you know, when you'd say hello. I mean, I'm being kind of funny.
Can I have
a
number?
She would do wolf stuff.
Oy vey.
Yeah. So this is a thing. Like, it's not that hard to think about, because think about most of your habits, you know, they come from a kind of education your parents gave you. Like, you know, don't chew with your mouth open. You know, this is how you deal with other people, like really basic shit. And just you learn that from wolves instead of humans. So you
I'm not even talking about that, though, James, some level. On a purely physical level. Right. You're a human being walking around on 2 feet. Right. So you go and live with the wolves who walk on 4 feet. And then let's say for one time you walk into bushes or something and you hit your balls. And you look at all the other wolves who don't look the same as you, and don't you go, there's something wrong here? Like, how
well,
do
the
they don't even have the same...
around.
What?
The wolf girl crawled around. She was trying to fit it. She looked at the wolves and was like, oh, I guess that's how you know, propel yourself. I'm gonna walk like that, because that's how you do things. And so she learned to walk from wolves, I guess.
Yeah.
Now I'm even more terrified, because you know what this tells me? The bottom for society is even lower than I thought it was, because this shows that humans can survive under literally animalistic conditions and be okay. That's terrifying.
When still survive, yeah.
Yes. I mean, look, this is one of Ayn Rand's more controversial points that to me was so blatantly clear, which is you have to choose to be a human being.
Yes.
Yes, you can be born with the chromosomes, you can look like a human. You can even mimic some of the behaviors, but ultimately, at the end of the day, it is about making an active choice with your mind, and that is what makes you a human being, a fully fulfilled, you know, insofar as you can be a human being. And far too many people don't do that. Not just the ones raised by wolves, the ones raised by other people who never chose to be a human being. So.
There it is. That was the suppressed premise I was making at the beginning, where I was saying human beings are terrible. And that's the question I want to ask you guys. So if we come to this conclusion that you just had, that you just made, that not all people choose to be human, and I would argue it's a very low percentage of people that choose to be human, how do we reconcile that with the idea that man is to be celebrated and that life is great and that people are great? Are we celebrating the potential and the people who chose that potential, and that's just the answer? And then it's just like, fuck it, fuck you to the rest of people? I just, what I'm wondering is, how do we not end up with a negative sense of life at this point?
Because...
Do you get what I mean?
I think you can celebrate it. I mean, I think that's... I don't know if this is easy, but I think I have the answer, which is that you celebrate the potentiality that you choose to make actual in your own life.
Yes, totally.
With the people you surround yourself with and with the choices you make.
And you surround
Do you
want to
make
with...
that simpler for the dum-dums like me?
and then James can come back in, but like you live the best life you can live, but you also surround yourself with good people. You surround yourself with beautiful things. You surround yourself with all the greatness of mankind, and then you take Rourke very seriously. When I read The Fountainhead, and the now very famous, burn against Tui, which is, what do you think of me? And Rourke says, but I don't think of you. You have to take that very seriously. Otherwise, you'll drive yourself insane. You'll drive yourself crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
You have to not think about the nonsense as much as you can, and think about it only insofar, or only in so much time as it takes to actually combat it, and then move on.
So, can you guys, like, get me a cabin in the woods somewhere that has everything I need and everything to keep me entertained? Because I don't see how you go about that approach without thinking about people, because these people are everywhere to me.
I do. Sorry, but I do.
My cabin in the woods is just called physics and philosophy of math.
Yeah, my cabin in the woods is called my iPhone with earbuds in and a book. It's interesting.
So I guess this is a longer discussion that we will continue overall. I think maybe this is the direction to go in with the show, because I think this is an element of witnessing the farce, is not thinking about these things, and when you do, laughing at them to treat them as not real. So the question is, how do you take this concept, this idea, and manifest it psychologically so it sticks in your brain? What kind of habits can you maintain? What kind of life can you live to make it and reinforce this for yourself. I think that's an interesting thing to track going forward and to keep in mind for all our discussions going forward. Because I think that's important to being an individual in general. Even in a rational society, you would need to do that. And I would argue that we don't have enough of that overall, that we all just don't think of these people and laugh at these people. We think about these people too much.
It is literally...
Yeah.
Well... I shouldn't say that because now I'm catching myself. It is certainly in some ways the complete opposite of being woke, by the way.
Yeah, that's a really good way to think of it.
And we'll dive into that more as I think about it. But yeah.
Well, right. But that's the irony of all the language that these people have always used. I mean, it's always been this inversion where they say they're woke, but really they're the ones who are asleep. It's always been that way with all of the language they've used. Yeah. They say they're fighting for freedom, but really they're fighting for oppression.
Good times. The Everything is Terrible edition, brought to you by Justin coming back from Europe.
Incidentally, Justin, this is very related to the thing I wanted to bring up after the show. So that's some behind the scenes for you mid-season.
Yeah, good pod.
I still think James is dying, by the way. Just everyone Secrets out there. If you find out that James is dying, you heard it from me first.
I think he's transitioning. So, into what? I don't know, but into something.
Well, I'm transitioning.
Thank you.
Into the art section.
You're welcome.
Let's talk about that in some reviews and some movies that are coming out in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio.
Focused on.
So we're going to do a couple quick reviews here. I'm going to review a movie. Daniel's going to review a sitcom that just came out. I think James is going to chime in on the movie as well. But to sort of give a little background on the movie I picked here, I had a lot of free time on my trip. And what I mean by that is there were long train rides. There was a 12-hour plane ride on the way back. So I binged a lot of The Walking Dead. I watched a lot of movies. But the funny thing is, on my way back, I started out by watching two movies that were directly relevant to what I had just been through. So one of them I watched was The Man from U.N.C.L.E., it stars Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer. And it's set in Berlin when it was divided. And Henry Cavill actually ziplines over the Berlin Wall. So I was like, Jesus, I don't want to deal with this anymore. Like, I don't want to hear about this shit. And so then, of course, I also decided to watch Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman as Neville Chamberlain, and I was like, no, that's wrong.
Opposite of Neville Chamberlain.
Yeah. that's wrong. Okay, so Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, and look, I would not knock the production of this movie, the acting in this movie, the cinematography, some of the directing was amazing. But I was initially hesitant to review this movie for one major reason. And that's the reason that, as with Daniel, I think a lot of listeners of this podcast want to like this type of movie. And this is the type of movie they're looking for. Now, I'm going to put in a caveat. I don't know if it's because I was watching this on a plane, and maybe all movies are worse on planes. But holy shit, I was bored by this slow-plotting movie for the first two-thirds of it. Now, the climax of this movie is tremendous. There is a scene on the underground in London, and there is the scene of the famous speech Churchill gave about like how we're going to keep fighting, which these two scenes are tremendous, and it built to that. And they had to build to that. But before that, James... This is like you with what's that show about the people where I called billions? People sitting in rooms and talking? Like,
dude, like, the best talking. This talking was almost as good as the talking in Billions.
Oh my god, I don't understand. Like, yeah, Winston Churchill is a hero. And yeah, there were assholes who were trying to do things against him. But is there a better way we can do it than him sitting in bed and yelling at his typist who he just hired for doing a bad job? Like, one of the big turns in the movie is in the beginning, the king doesn't like him. And then later the king shows up and was like, you know what? Actually, I was wrong about you. I like you. Which, yeah, that's great in reality, but that's a fucking boring ass movie. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
As much as I wanted to love this movie because it's sort of the companion piece for Dunkirk, all I could think of was I would have much rather enjoyed this if they had just edited this into Dunkirk as an aside to it. Like, oh, by the way, this is what's going on while these people are trying to survive. And now Daniel can shut up about Dunkirk not having a story.
Dear Midsiders.
Maybe you can just have a fourth storyline for Dunkirk that's like in parallel and it's Gary Oldman like yes. doing all these political things. Like you have
Dear Midsiders.
You have different time frames.
I will time pay $100 then for anyone to splice together Dunkirk and Darkest Hour.
Yeah, but you know how it's like each of the different subplots took place in a different amount of time. Like one was 3 days, one was like 1 day or and then one was 1 hour.
Yes, in the Darkest Hour.
One that was like 4 months, and it was Darkest Hour.
Yes, exactly. Except it wouldn't say 4 hours for Darkest Hour. It would say four fucking ever, because that's how long the fucking movie felt. So, James, I'm guessing you liked this more than me.
I don't know. I have the same set of things that I liked, but I have a different set of complaints. I don't mind people sitting in rooms talking. I didn't mind the first two thirds of this movie, because the first two thirds showed what a character Winston Churchill was, and I was entertained. But what I didn't like is it didn't have enough drama in it. I didn't feel the drama of Winston Churchill's choice to stick to his guns and go to war with Germany. Or what was exactly his choice? It was something like that, to really stick to what it was he had said to begin with. He wavers and then he chooses. And I didn't feel like that choice was very well dramatized.
He right, because it was people sitting in rooms talking to each other.
What's that?
I said because it was people sitting in rooms talking to each other. No, I agree completely with that. The choice was, does he give in and do a peace treaty, or does he continue to fight? That was the choice.
Spoilers.
Yeah.
I don't care about spoilers because it's World War II.
I'm just kidding. It's a historical piece. Yeah, I know how it
historical
ends.
Historical spoilers, guys. England did go to war against Germany. They didn't sign a peace treaty.
Wait, Daniel, what's the movie about Hitler in his cabin? Or in not his cabin. In his bunker.
Downfall.
Yes, Downfall.
It's Downfall?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like this was the companion piece to that. Like, you should watch this movie if you enjoyed Downfall and didn't think that was boring as shit, because that movie's boring as shit, too.
I love it.
You love it?
Justin, what did you think of the movie Valkyrie with Tom Cruise?
I didn't see that shit. I don't usually watch these. Look, I watched this for two reasons, okay? Well, three reasons. One, I was just back from Europe and fucking depressed. So I watched it because I was like, yeah, I want to remember like how an actually good country fights for shit. The second reason I watched it is I knew people who listened to the show and people like Daniel really, you know, like these kind of movies. And, the third reason I watched it is I heard the performance was tremendous. So I wanted to see it. I mean, I guess also the fourth reason I was sitting on a plane, it was like, do I want to sit here and watch the Joss Whedon destroy Justice League again or watch this? Although funny story about that, I actually got fed up with the movie choices and watched La La Land again. So I'm sitting there and I'm watching La La Land and it's some scene where, oh no, I remember what it was. It was, remember the audition she gives at the end where she sings about like all the dreamers and everything?
Yeah.
And then I look to the left and my girlfriend's mother is watching the Justice League and I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. Like if this doesn't like speak to our culture, I don't know what does. Like the two extremes of our culture are right there.
Yeah. It's interesting. So not recommending.
Anyway, you should watch this movie if you're like Daniel and you liked the bunker movie. What's it called again, Daniel?
Downfall.
Downfall. If you like those kind of movies, if you like billions like James, see this movie. You shouldn't watch this movie if you like good movies.
Well, Alex Inc. is about as different from the darkest hour as you could possibly pick. Justin, I believe that you watched this pilot as well.
No, I didn't have time, which is one of the reasons I decided to watch Darkest Hour.
Well, okay, so it'll be super quick. The review will be super, super quick because it's
well, the reason fluff. I want you to review it is it's about podcasting, correct?
That's right. It stars Zach Braff, who is Alex, who the plot is he quits his day job, which is working for a podcast at essentially an NPR-esque company, but they only tell positive sort of nonsense fluff stories, and he wants to tell real stories. That's his whole thing, is he wants to tell real stories. And so he quits his job and starts a podcast, except he needs investors and he needs employees, and I didn't know podcasts were so expensive, but apparently it is. And essentially, it's sort of, the first episode is how he goes about making this pipe dream at least possible in this storyline, with the support of his very diverse family. He's married to an Indian woman, and their children look black and Armenian, so I'm not exactly sure how that works, but nonetheless...
It's called adoption, Daniel.
I guess. For anyone who knows, this will be funny, and for anyone who doesn't, you will think I'm speaking nonsense. His wife looks like Debbie Gatte. Okay, moving on with that.
I know who the actress is.
Yes, his wife looks like Debbie Gatte. Google it.
Okay.
And so here's the thing. It's an ABC sitcom. It sort of has that feel to it. Here are the positive elements. It's witty. The children in the show are not insufferable, which is not always the case for sitcoms. In fact, the son is delightfully funny. The wife is insufferable, but alas. And Zach Braff, it turns out he can be comedic without being dopey, which is interesting. He doesn't have to rely on the fact that he looks goofy in order to be funny. So, you should watch this show if you like super lighthearted stories about entrepreneurs, I think. And it's very fluffy overall. For the fact that he's doing a podcast about serious issues, the show is super fluff. And you should not watch this show if you need deep substance in your art, because there is really no deep substance here. It's very tiddly-winky in a certain sense, which can be fine. That can be a value, and you can like that and enjoy it.
Yeah.
I will probably give this one or two more episodes and then probably never watch it again.
How would you compare this against Silicon Valley, now that you say it's comedy with an entrepreneurial... flair.
Silicon Valley is way more complex. It's way more integrated of a plot. This is very much your typical sitcom where everything is contained in one episode. You don't need to watch the previous episode to really understand what's going on. And it's like if Silicon Valley is a steak dinner and scotch, this is a cotton candy with a side of a pixie stick.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
So I have to ask, when is Silicon Valley coming back, or have I missed episodes? I mean, this is completely non-entertaining for people out there. I just want to know for myself.
I think it's back. Yeah.
Is it back? I've been missing episodes.
They have like 3 episodes out, I think, by now.
They have too much shit to watch. Oh, my God.
I've seen buses
it's a good
advertising it, therefore I think it's back.
Once
route, I assume it's out.
Yeah, that's good to know. So get out there, watch some Silicon Valley sans TJ Miller, because he didn't re-sign, which will be interesting to see. But let's talk about some other stuff that's going to come out and give us more things to add to our list of things to watch, maybe. Although I'm thinking no for James because of things he said pre-show.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Upgrade is a sci-fi drama thriller from one of the creators of the Saw franchise. I would describe it as Memento meets, I don't know, like AI or so, any sort of robot type movie. And in it, a guy is attacked and his wife is murdered and he becomes a quadriplegic. They then make him part robot. Oh, so Iron Man. I would call it Memento meets Iron Man. And he becomes quadriplegic and they make him part robot. And then he uses the robot, which has these extra powers, which are sort of like Jarvis and Iron Man. And those powers help him deduce who killed his wife, but also he can like basically turn his brain off or give it control, and then it will fight other people. I think it's an sort of interesting premise, but there are very interesting questions of personhood here. Like, if there's just something that can take over my body, aren't I no longer a person because it's making all of the decisions what to do? So then I'm just sort of like a passenger in my own body. Maybe the movie will go into this because the first Saw was very smart in that way. So I am actually willing to give this movie a chance. This is a hug for me. Daniel?
Nah. I don't know. I mean, it looks... There's some elements of this that are unique. I like to reward that. But... what I don't like is a lot of the gore stuff. Like, if you can stylize the violence, I'm in, but this was a Red Band trailer, and thus it had some darn near decapitations and some compound fractures, and...
It was by one of the Saw creators.
I know, and I'm not into that. The first Saw movie was the only movie worth seeing.
Yeah, there's kind of no reason to have that in this film.
Yeah, it just seemed... You know? So, I like some of the lighting. Overall, I think unless this sort of, like, appears sort of randomly in my Netflix queue when I'm at home and, you know, sipping on some bourbon and sort of, like, too reluctant to move to the remote to change it, then it's gonna be a tackle.
James?
Definitely not a tackle. This looks like a good movie. This looks like a non-stupid movie with just, it's just fun. It's just cool. But that being said, that's just not good enough for me to watch it. Like, I'm a busy man, Justin. I have better things to do probably. So, I mean, I guess tackle because I'm not going to watch it. Doesn't look bad though. So,
But that is part of your value system, James, is deciding what movies fit into that or not. That is fine. That is part of the metric for hugging or tackling.
Yeah.
So it's not just if a movie looks... It's not just if a movie looks good or not. It's if you're going to take the time to see it.
Right, right. That is a good metric.
Second trailer.
Ahocalypse, and no, I am not saying that incorrectly, is... a zombie apocalypse hockey movie. This trailer was submitted by Midsider Ronnie.
What?
Because as we know, he is a big hockey fan. For anyone who listened to our football podcast, Belichick God Your Premises, he would often respond to us with things about hockey, which is a little weird because it's a football podcast. But so he decided to bring that to the Midside. And he found the right crowd. Because for me... this is horror comedy. It's zombies. I am the right audience for this trailer, even though I know nothing about hockey. I mean, at a certain point, it actually said featuring, and I'm pulling up the guy's name right here, featuring Kelly Chase. And I was like, yeah, that's got to be a hockey player. I had no idea who he was. I looked him up. He played in the league for 450, Wikipedia's loading, 458 games. So there's somebody in the trailer who played professional hockey for a very long time.
So even though I didn't know hockey, got it.
One season of hockey. That's true. I was looking at that through NFL lines and NFL eyes, and I was like, "Damn, that guy is more prolific than Tom Brady." Jesus.
Well, I mean, that would only be half a season of baseball.
I know. So. It's true. God,
they're playing like three games every day.
Okay.
That's right. They get like a 900 game season.
To echo
Let's not bag on hockey. Let's not bag on hockey.
I'm bagging on
Don't
baseball.
Don't piss Ronnie off.
To echo Corolla, like when it comes up and it's like, oh, the Brewers are 39-39. It's like, really? Really? This doesn't seem worth it. Yeah.
So I forgot completely what I was saying now because you sidetracked it with this whole discussion.
How does it feel?
I don't know what I was going to say. I love the self-awareness of the trailer where it said, I don't remember the exact wording, but one of the words that popped up where it was like the best hockey/zombie movie of the year or whatever. I was
the
like,
most
okay.
Feel good hockey zombie movie of the year.
Yes, yes. And I was like, okay, self-awareness. This checks all of my metrics. The only thing that would make this better if it was a football movie and it said featuring Rob Gronkowski, hug.
Hug.
Daniel?
Well, you could be the one to make football-calypse. That doesn't work. Touchdown-calypse? Whatever. Braid-pocalypse? Gronk-pocalypse. There, I got there. Gronk-pocalypse. Yeah, Gronk-pocalypse is better, thank you. Okay, so you could make that one, now that we're in the genre. This movie looks like trash.
I don't want to give Gronk a reason to retire. If I write that script and give it to him, that will definitely make him decide to retire.
Just pocket it. Just put it in that back pocket and wait until he wins his next Super Bowl and then go after
him. I'll put it in my back pocket, man. Put it in your pocket.
Like, put it and be like Joe, you know, the Joe Green thing where he's like, you know, drinking a Coke and you throw it to him. Yeah, be great. So this movie looks like trash. I couldn't actually discern from the trailer if they were real zombies or fake zombies, because at one point they were putting on makeup, and I thought, well, are they pretending to be zombies? Is this some sort of weird competition movie? And then someone's head got split open, and they were drinking blood, and I just thought that I can't do zombie movies anymore, Justin. You know that there are basically two zombie movies that need to be made, two that are left, I mean, to be made, and that's it. And other than that, I'm done with zombies. They need to go into the, you know, the like Disney does with their movies, go into the vault for a little while so we can all clamor for them again. That's what we need to do with zombie movies as a genre. Let's put them in the vault, let it percolate a little, and bring it out like 30 years from now. Have some more good zombie movies. But until then, tackle.
Tackle.
Daniel, so are you saying you wish zombie movies could die? Is that what you're saying?
Thank you. Yes, boom, headshot to the zombie movies.
James?
Justin.
No. Say Ronnie, if you're going to say these things.
What are you doing to us? What have you done, Justin? What have you done?
Okay, just say tackle so I can ask you a question since you're grandstanding right now.
What have you... Yeah, tackle. What's your question?
Would you guys rather watch this movie or whatever movie won the Oscar this year? Was it The Shape of Water? Would you rather watch this movie or The Shape of Water?
My God.
Oh, God. Don't even...
Why would you do that?
I have...
That's offensive. That's nearly offensive. Why would you... I would rather a hypothetical that involved fornicating with a relative than that hypothetical.
I don't need to hear about your Oedipus complex. Just answer the question.
I said a relative. Could be any relative. I don't have that many. probably this movie. But I would have to be a little bit drunk. Like a little bit.
I think fornicate with a relative. Was that an option, Justin?
Well, now that we've learned about everyone's Oedipal complexes, we have the perfect way to go into the next trailer, I think.
Final trailer.
The Cleanse stars Johnny Galecki, a.k.a. Leonard, from The Big Bang Theory. And in it, he goes to a psychological retreat where they give him juice cleanses. And at the end of that day, he spits up something. And that something is, I'm assuming, his demons. His inner demons.
Yes.
And then he has to figure out how to deal with it. The trailer is very short on what happens after he spits up his demons. It's very short on if this is all the exposition or if they've given us the entire plot, which is the entire problem. Because if that was like the first 10 minutes and then he had to figure out how to deal with it through the rest, that could be conceivably interesting. But if that's the entire movie... And that's like the payoff. It's like that's a shit movie. So this trailer is really hard to decipher. But there's one thing in this trailer that I was like, nope, fuck you guys. Fuck you guys for two reasons because of this. In the trailer, up on the screen, it popped up a positive review from Birth Movies Death. Nope. Nope. I'm fucking out for two reasons. If Birth Movies Death says a movie is good... It's got to be shit. And second off, if you are dumb enough to think praise from them is praise, there's no way your movie can be good. I'm all the worst possible incarnations, the worst possible things you can think about this movie have to be true about it based upon that fact. Tackle. Daniel?
Well, I think the one redeeming factor of this movie is that the inner demon is played by Danny DeVito. But other than that, I got nothing.
That sounds racist to me. Like, you make the short dude play that demon?
It's not just short. It looks like Danny DeVito. Look at it. Google that. It's on the Midside page. All right, Tackle.
My opinion of this is like Justin's, only instead of there being one thing that turned me off during the trailer, there was like one thing that didn't turn me off during the trailer, and that was the fact that it would end.
It will end, yes.
I want to be clear though.
So like while it was difficult for me, it was difficult for me to get through these two-minute trailers you had me watch to prepare for this show, Justin.
All right,
Justin.
Yeah, I'm glad I destroyed your weekend with 2 minutes. Jesus fucking Christ. But no, let me be clear. This movie could be even worse. It could be naturalistic, right? But the idea of like, hey, we're going to concretize the demon as this little creature that when you do a cleanse, it spits out and then you have to figure out how to deal with it. If somebody told me that premise on its own, I'd be like, yeah, I like that. That's a good idea. Now let me see what you do with it. The problem is this trailer is just so shitty that it takes whatever this interesting idea is and makes it look like they executed it in the worst way possible.
Yeah. Fair enough.
To me, it looks like they took this really, really straightforward idea, this idea that takes a complex psychological phenomenon and makes it super boringly simple, physically simple, and then just kind of jacked themselves off for 2 minutes about how clever they were that they thought of this.
Yes.
But it's not that clever, except it's not that clever.
Yes.
It's just really straightforward.
Boy, James, way to describe all of Hollywood.
I know. That's what I was just thinking.
You know what that describes to me is the movie Moon. You ever see Moon?
Is that the... No. That the story
That's
of,
the one where Jim Carrey plays, what's his name?
It's not Jim Carrey.
Is that the one where Jim Carrey makes
him? Oh, sorry, Sam Rockwell.
Hmm. No, Moon, the movie Moon is just this, like, low-budget sci-fi movie that
starring Sam Rockwell.
Really artsy and cool. Okay, I didn't know it was that. And, it like, you can see the ending from, like, 60 miles away because there's, like, at least 60 Star Trek episodes that have similar plots, only the Star Trek episodes had like the decency to give variations on this plot, but they just put forward the most simple, straightforward version of that plot, so you know exactly what the twist at the end is going to be, and they just revel in that completely generic twist, and then it ends.
That's like the show This Is Us, where it starts out at the beginning, it's like X amount of people have the same birthday, blah, blah, blah. And then they start telling the story of four people who have the same birthday. One of them is a couple and the daughter, or I guess five, maybe, I don't know. A couple and the wife is about to give birth. And then there are three others who are adults who are like around the same age. And I'm watching it and I'm going, okay, this is really stupid. There has to be something going on here. And I remember somebody had told me a twist. And after about 5 minutes, I went, oh, there's a time lapse here, and these are triplets who are born on the same day as their mother when she gave birth to them. And then that's the end of the episode, and they edit it and cut it like it's this epic reveal. It's like, oh my god, these are actually the kids, and we're telling the story of their parents raising them as we're showing the effects in their life as adults. And I'm like, this is dumb.
No, it's genius. Oh, I long for the sixth sense.
That was actually telegraphed, too. Do you realize the scene where he says, I see dead people, the camera is directly on Bruce Willis?
Yeah, well, I leaned over to my mother, who I saw this with, I think it was in high school, in like the first 12 minutes and said, I think he's dead. And she went, shh. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about other things that are disappointing, huh? You guys said you wanted to hear about my Europe trip, right?
Well, might as well have some therapy. Sure. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just giving you, this is the last chance. Like, if we can back out of this, I can find some questions on Reddit right now. Are you sure you want to do this?
Justin's European vacation, let's go. Scotty doesn't know that Fiona and me do it in my van every Sunday. She tells him she's in church, but she doesn't go. Still, she's on her knees, and Scotty doesn't know. Oh, Scotty doesn't know. Oh. So don't tell Scotty.
For those of you wondering why I selected that pop punk song, as Daniel asked, what pop punk song are you going to pick for this? That is from the movie Eurotrip. It is the song Scotty Doesn't Know. There is no other song you can use to introduce a discussion of a European vacation than Scotty Doesn't Know. Go listen to that song. It's one of the best pop punk songs ever made, I would argue. Daniel, I know you're shocked that I actually found a song.
I am, but if there was going to be someone whose encyclopedic knowledge of pop punk could lead them to a European-esque song for this segment, it would be one Justin M. Lesneski.
There's also She Wants to Move to London, or the song I believe is just called London by Seaway. That one would have been a decent one, too. So there are plenty of pop punk songs there that would be relevant. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're not here to talk about pop punk. We're here to talk about my experiences, of which I had many, and there are many things that I could talk about, so I don't know. This segment may meander, and I'm hoping, Daniel and James, you guys can focus in on some things here. But I just kind of want to do this like Adam and Drew style, when you listen to the Adam and Dr. Drew show, and they're like, these are the things I've been thinking about. So, Daniel, the first thing is social media. And what I mean by that is, like, I am pretty much done with social media now. And it's not because of the people in Europe. It's because of what I saw from people interacting with my girlfriend's social media. And what I mean by that is she would post pictures like from the day, like on Instagram, and also share them on Facebook. I don't know if you saw any of her posts. Did you?
Kind of. I don't really do the Instagram story thing, but I did see like some standalone pictures that she posted.
Right, so she'll go through and like, because on Instagram you can do like the multiple ones where you do like, you swipe right on it and there are multiple pictures. So she would do that and she would say like, this is what I did today. What really bothered me about the way people responded to it is it wasn't people like, oh, hey, that looks really cool. Like, what did you think of that thing? What did you think of that thing? Or it wasn't even like, oh, yeah, I was there once and I really enjoyed this part of it. Did you see it? I would like to see what you thought of that as well. It would literally, people would reply and be like, oh, I'm leaving on a trip now too, or soon. Or somebody else would reply, loved Budapest, when my girlfriend did a whole day about all the things she did in Budapest. And to me, those replies are incredibly obnoxious. Can you imagine, like, somebody, like, does a play or does a movie, and, like, you go up, you go to their premiere, and you go to them after and you shake their hand and you just say, when they're shaking your hand, you go, my movie comes out next week. Like, am I crazy? That just really bothers me and it makes me fucking hate social media. I just feel like social media has become this completely narcissistic thing where people just go on and talk about themselves and what they're doing and they don't know how to have conversations with other people.
It's very funny. It reminds me, Justin, of when I first got into the digital strategy business, you know, all the way back in 2009. One of the things I would counsel people on, brands specifically, is that it's called social media, and that if you continually broadcasted stuff about your brand, people would be dissuaded from participating. And I used to give the example, Justin, of going to a party and being the guy at the party who only talks about whatever the hell he's up to and how obnoxious that is. Little did I know that would just become a fact of life on social media and not something that people are averse to. In fact, I would say that most social media now is simply created for a way to allow people to broadcast their own crap onto whatever it is that you're posting. So it's not about conversation. It's not about being social. It's completely a misnomer now. It's not social media. It's broadcast media online.
Broadcast media online for people who have nothing to broadcast.
Yeah, totally. It's sort of let's call it Truman Show media.
And the added step here that really bothered me was not only is it like that, like fine, you want to have Instagram stories, like my sister-in-law, if you watch her Instagram stories, and heaven forbid she listens to this, but fuck it, whatever, my family already hates me. Like, we were so bored in Europe that sometimes we would watch it, and like she posts like the most insane things on social media. Like, I've never seen someone work out for 2 years and gain weight, but that's fine. Oh, like, if you want to do that, like in your own little world, that's fine. But the second you start going on somebody else's posts, and rather than replying to them and just saying, oh, yo, you just said you're leaving on a trip. Well, I leave for a different trip soon. That is like a whole other level of tone deaf and socially inept to me.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think the purpose of social media is so different now than it was when we started using it, which is strange. The culture of social media has changed so drastically. And when I first engage, it was a way to sort of keep up with people so that I could actually know what was going on in their life. And now it's this sort of way to broadcast. It's a way to be second-handed, essentially. It's a way to project what I want other people to think about me instead, which is, I don't know, it's abhorrent to me that that's what it's become, but alas.
Yeah. And when we're talking about things that are abhorrent to me because of what they've become, or what they always were, I think that's probably the most interesting thing to me is, fuck Europe. And what I mean by that is, this is actually the second time I've been to Europe. When I was the summer between my 7th and 8th grade year, I did this thing called People to People Student Ambassadors. We didn't really do ambassador things, they just called it that, but whatever, I got to go to Europe. And I went to England, France, Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands on that trip. And I distinctly remember when I was there how old things were and how much I realized that America was awesome. And that was a very foundational experience for me. It was like I came back and I was like, okay, America's awesome. Why is America awesome? How did it become this way? And I think that's a lot of why I believe what I believe, because I investigated those things. But now going back this time, we started in Amsterdam, Berlin. We went to Berlin. We did a day in Bruges. Wasn't like the movie in Bruges. We went to Warsaw. We went to Krakow, which was Auschwitz. We can talk about that if you want. Then there was Prague, Vienna, and Budapest. And just from a historical note, what really stands out is the story of this region is pretty much the same. All of these countries, in the form we know them as, didn't really happen until after the Cold War. And what I mean by that is there was a lot of empire building and a lot of geographical unrest pre-World War II. Then World War II came around. The Nazis took all these countries over. Germany took all these countries over. And then after World War II, the Allies divided them up and set their borders. And then the areas I was in were really Russian and communist controlled. So these countries have really only had independence and democracy, whatever form of democracy they say they have, since the late 80s, early 90s, since the wall came down, since the 90s when they had their own federations or republics or whatever form they want to have. So even though these countries are very old, sort of culturally and old architecturally, America is a much older country and has much more of a cultural tradition, an intellectual tradition, really. That's what it really boils down to. Because what I really began to understand when I went through all of this is, when I went around, is why these countries are so collectivistic. And that's because really the only thing that has ever bound them together is that they lived and survived together and spoke the same language. All of the boundaries are really, all of the borders are really what language these people speak. And they have suffered through the years these horrible tragedies of all of these different invasions, basically. I mean, you had the Roman Empire, then you had Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, and in there was the Habsburgs, or these people who ruled most of these regions. Then you had Hitler, then you had the communists through Stalin. And all of these people had to survive as a group. And the idea that we look to Europe and say, oh, well, they've got it figured out. No, they are so far behind us in so many ways. You know, I'm sure there are great Europeans out there, and I know we have European listeners, so I don't want to say, like, all Europeans are terrible, but it's just so obvious how far behind they are. And just the myths we as a culture have about these countries, I'm going to throw a myth out to you guys, and I'm going to destroy a myth that you may not even know is a myth. Marijuana is not legal in Amsterdam. Did you know that?
No, I assumed it was not only legal, but, like, mandatory.
No, they just have the idea that we can't stop kids from smoking weed, so we're not going to try because it's a waste of our time. Basically, sorry for any Dutch listeners out there. If there's one, the first thing I learned on this trip is that the Dutch are pussies, okay? They're just like, oh, you know, sailors like prostitutes, so we're going to legalize prostitution, and we're not going to worry about kids who smoke weed, whatever. It's not worth the effort. And they also thought, like, oh, if we just, like, stay out of Hitler's way, he won't invade us and take over.
They certainly have what was the word you used, Justin?
I use lots of words
to describe the Dutch.
Any more? Pussies.
Yes.
A lot of words.
They have the language most associated with that, I think. If you ever listen to them speak, it's very bizarre. So.
Yeah, I mean, dude, they're very laid back. Like, the Dutch are very nice people. They're great. But it's just that they're pussies. That's all it is. Like, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, look, I have so many stories I can tell. Like, do you want me to talk about how people were standing in line to get into Auschwitz, which is, like, the weirdest fucking thing in the world? Like, literally, right? We're standing in line to get into Auschwitz, and I'm like, something's wrong here. Like, there's something wrong. Like, people literally were lined up to come in here before. And then when we're in there, you literally walk through one of the gas chambers. So you line up to walk through Auschwitz, and then you walk through a gas chamber, and I'm like, in a matter of how many decades, it's completely inversed. It's just bizarre to me. And, dude, there were people there taking selfies at Auschwitz. Like, there was a giant urn when they were like, in this urn is the ashes that the Nazis didn't know how to dispose of. So they just started using urns. And somebody had her son take a picture of her standing next to it smiling. I'm just like, what?
All that is particularly strange to me. We have the National Holocaust Museum in D.C., which I have never been to and will never go to. I sort of understand why it's necessary, and I get it. I just emotionally, psychologically could never do that to myself. I don't know. It just feels wrong. Like, I get it intellectually by reading about it. I don't really need that much more. So, but I do have some questions for you. But first, I will say that so my wife went to France last year, and when she came back and I asked her for her review, I said, what did you think of France? And her first and pretty much her only response was, they don't deserve the Louvre. That's what her review of France was, which I thought was hilarious. And I asked why, and she said, because they're animals, barbarians. It's basically a third world country. So... So Justin, of the countries that you visited, which would you say is the most like America in any way? I have a guess, but
Vienna, Austria. What was your guess?
Oh no, my guess would have been Berlin. But
I fucking hated Berlin. we can go into that in a second, but
so
no,
why
Vienna, Austria.
Vienna, and then why did you hate Berlin?
Okay, Vienna for a couple reasons. I would say Vienna is the most Americanized city. Like, it was very much, there was a lot of American brands and shopping there. It very much reminded me of LA in that way, and I'll fold that into my last reason in a second. Vienna is a very, I guess my last two reasons as far as why Vienna. Vienna is very much an artistic city, where they very much pay attention to the architecture and the presentation. They try to have reasons for it. Now they just end up emulating a lot of the other great architectural styles. I mean, they're very Italian influenced. A lot of this trip was just like, yeah, I want to go to Italy because you guys all just kind of tried to steal Italian architecture. So I think Austria actually, Vienna tries to have a culture and tries to be independent and be individualistic in their sort of psychological approach to art. So I think that makes them the most American in that way. And also they're super fucking arrogant there. Like they had the audacity. The tour guide was like, yeah, we're the heart of Europe. And I was like, what? Who the fuck has ever called Vienna the heart of Europe? And then they're talking about like how their great delicacy of the Wiener Schnitzel, which by the way, the Wiener Schnitzel restaurant doesn't even serve Wiener Schnitzel. Wiener Schnitzel is just you take veal, you pound it till it's really flat and you fry it. And every restaurant in Vienna serves this, which, okay, you know, it's not bad, but they're like, oh, Wiener Schnitzel, it's a delicacy. And then they have this cake called soccer. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, which is basically just chocolate cake. It's pretty good, but they're like, you can only get that here in Vienna. And I was like, this is the most American I felt on this entire trip. So I would say that Vienna is the most American place I went to.
I was going
to
say, in terms of, you know, being self-centered or whatever, America is the country that goes around saying we're the best country on the planet. So I do like that element about Vienna. Never been there, but sounds
Vienna was very clean, though. I will say I liked that very much. They were clean. Their subway was clean. So I will say that about Vienna. Good job, Vienna.
Good job.
No, fuck Berlin. So, why would you Justin, think Berlin?
To me, Germany seems like the most Americanized of the European countries. But, I mean, other than England.
I mean, it sort of was. Like, we went on this food tour, right? It was its art and food tour, which, you know, Berlin has this love of graffiti now because one of the ways they rebelled during communism was West Berlin would do all this graffiti on the wall. So they basically don't erase graffiti anywhere in Berlin now. So there's graffiti everywhere, which I get it from a sense of life of the German perspective. That's the biggest thing is now I understand the sense of life of all these countries. But it's just like fucking I don't want to be in a country, in a city that has fucking graffiti everywhere. So we're on this tour, this food tour, and the girl is basically a German hipster. She's from, I think she was from Careful. Romania, and she's living in Berlin.
Well, you pronounce that.
Although Hitler was an Austrian, BT dub.
I gotcha.
You knew that, right?
Yeah, just be careful. Yeah. Just saying.
Okay. So no, she's not even German, and she brings us to basically the Brooklyn of Berlin, and serves us 99% Turkish food on the German food tour. And she's like, since the immigrants have come in, they've really affected Berlin culture. And I was like, oh, God, you fucking hipster.
That's funny.
Well, my girlfriend, I don't know if you guys heard her on the recording. I don't know if you guys heard her. Just said, we had currywurst, which is where they take a sausage. What was it? Sausage? Sausage, and they put curry powder on it, which sounds like Berlin, right? That sounds Berlin. eating it, but that's this is what I'm saying, where these people don't have cultures. They're just a mishmash of whatever fucking invading force came in.
Yeah.
But as far as Berlin, I have to tell a story about Berlin, and I shared this in a thread with a couple of Midsiders and Daniel. And this is the thing that made me the most angry throughout the entire trip. This is one of your native Illinois people, Daniel. So our tour guide around Berlin was a kid who majored in history at the University of Illinois.
Side note, and that means he knows nothing about history. The University of Illinois is total crap.
He didn't know how to respond to me because I asked him specifically where he went to school because I wanted to know that going forward before the tour began. And I said, you know, where'd you go to school? And he said, University of Illinois. And my only response to not be a dick was, cool. And he replied, cool, because he didn't know how to take my response. But my response was very passive aggressively. I don't want to be a dick right now because your education sucks. No, he was also very concrete bound. He's like, I'm really good with numbers and dates. And I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be a good tour. But what was really bad about this tour was in the middle of the tour, we went to, and this is the real name, the Memorial for the Murdered Jews of Europe. This is set up in the middle of Berlin, and it's done in a way that it's these giant metal columns that are organized in a very systematic way. you know, obviously to show the Holocaust. There, the number doesn't mean anything. The number of columns, it was just done in this way. But this is midway through the tour. And the tour guide stops us when we're all gathered as a group, and he goes on a little rant. And he says, you know, seeing this and living around this, and like, I guess his grandfather was a Polish Jew who survived the Holocaust and everything. You know, that's terrible. That's tragic. I'm sorry to hear that. And I'm sorry that's part of his family history. Obviously, it should not be part of anyone's history. But he sits there and he goes, this memorial is a reminder of when people act in this way and how we must stand up because the Europeans didn't. And the people in Berlin now and people in Germany now, the Germans, know that you have to stand up about against this when you see it happening, and you have to stand up for truth and what you know is right. And he goes, and as an American, that weighs on my mind a lot, especially recently with the election of Trump.
Oy.
And it took everything in me not to be like, you want me to stand up for what's right and what's true, and you're going to sit here and basically call Trump a Nazi? Do you realize how you just shit on the memory of all of these Jews that you were just telling us that it's important to remember the tragedy of their experience? I didn't even want to go into the American political aspect of it, but this is what we're exporting from America now. This is somebody who's so ashamed of America that he goes out there and he says these things to other people, and that's what people in Europe see as American.
Oy, that and Tide Pod eating is what we're shipping off to the whole world.
I wish this guy had eaten a Tide Pod. Then he wouldn't be giving these speeches.
I like to remind people, by the way, sort of a side note, that Germany was the most progressive country on the planet before they became Nazis. Just to be really clear about that.
Yeah. Worth noting.
I mean, but that's the other kind of thing, right? We have this whole political spectrum where it's right versus left. And it's supposed to be like fascism versus like the left thinks they're freedom or something. I don't really understand it.
Communism,
I've always said
in the middle.
What?
It's like fascism versus communism, and there's a golden mean in between the two.
Yeah.
Of just the perfect kind of collectivism.
Right. No, exactly. And that's exactly what I was just going to say, James. I've always said it should basically be a circle where on one side is freedom and the other side is oppression. And either direction you go, right or left on the circle, you still end up the exact opposite of authoritarianism, oppression, whatever you want to call it, the opposite of freedom. And I'm so tired of hearing this because people spin it to their ways, right? You start hearing where they talk about the Nazis and they say National Socialist Party, National Socialist Party. And then all of a sudden they'll go right-wing thinker Hitler, or Hitler and his right-wing politics got him elected. And I'm like, how did we go from National Socialist Party, which you guys just said 8 times, to right-wing thinker? And it's just tough because you go here and you see these people who have suffered. And you see the results of the society where they've suffered. Where, like I said, so many monarchs and wars fought. And then the Nazis come in. And then the communists come in. And, you know, you speak about, like, Poland specifically, right? Poland's very nationalistic right now. To the point of racism. I mean, we're on the train going into Poland. No other country besides Amsterdam when we flew in checked our passports. My girlfriend's parents, they checked their passports on the train to Poland when we got across the border. And then people were very racist towards them in the country. They didn't do anything like endangering, but we're in the mall and my girlfriend buys like a pretzel. It was a pretzel she bought. And the woman who sold it to her was this old woman. And you could tell she was just super racist with how like dismissive she was of her. Now she did sell her the pretzels, so it's ultimately like whatever, but you understand why these people are this way. It's very wrong to be this way. But all they've had is Poland in specific. Invaded. You know, you go to Auschwitz. The first 200,000 people or whatever killed in Auschwitz, I don't remember the exact number, it's some high number like that, were Polish, right? What people don't understand about Auschwitz, there were actually multiple camps. That camp you know of, which from Schindler's List, where the track goes right up the middle and there are all the bunkers on either side, that's the second one they built. The first one, which is Auschwitz sort of proper, I guess, was mainly Polish people killed there. You know, and then the Russians came in and the communism, right? The Soviet USSR with Stalin, and we know how many fucking people they killed. So you get why these people are collectivistic. You get why, especially Poland, with that history, is nationalistic. But you also have to understand that that's years of trauma speaking, and it's made them behind the curve and behind the times. Like, I don't believe in the idea of, you know, white privilege or any of these things, but if there's anything that makes you privileged as America, it's we've had one terrible war on our soil, and it was a civil war, and it was not about regions. It was not about which emperor was going to be in charge, which monarch was going to be in charge. It wasn't about measuring dick sizes. It wasn't about exterminating a race. It was about whether everybody deserved to be free or not. And even the World War that we got sucked into, World War II, right? And we were in World War I. But World War II has had such an effect on our psyche, right? We saw how dropping the bomb on Japan has affected our psyche as a country and the way we approach wars. And we feel this guilt about going in and wanting to put forward freedom in other countries. Even that had, you know, that's affected even our country. But even that was a European war. And I just think of the world as a whole and how, you know, Europe is ahead of other regions of the world, and I'm going to leave that as a suppressed premise for listeners to figure out. If there's one thing that America is lucky about, is that we were founded on ideas that make this aggression much less likely and allowed us to develop in the way we did because of our respect for individual rights and our respect for the progress of the mind and letting people develop on their own. And the more we move towards disrespecting personhood and disrespecting other individuals and narcissism, basically, the more we are going to become like these countries. My girlfriend said it best at a certain point. And this is a Californian. This is a native Los Angeles. Los Angelino, or however the fuck you say it, saying this. She said, you know, people say Americans are entitled, but Europeans are even more entitled. And I don't think there's anything better to sum up my takeaway from that experience. You know, I bag on California all the time, and I ultimately do want to live here, or do want to leave here, don't want to live here because of the cost of living and other problems. But even just being back here for a day or so after having been there, there is no comparison between anywhere in America and anywhere in Europe.
Well, my goodness, what a way to witness the farce over there in Europe. What an ending to that. That's ridiculous. And people wonder why I don't want to travel.
I actually thought about that on the trip. I literally had that thought. I was like, man, I understand why Daniel doesn't travel. Like, I thought about the money I spent on the trip and the experience I had, and I was like, I get it. I get why Daniel didn't want to travel. Like, I could save this money and, like, shoot a short movie. Yeah. I could put it towards a down payment. Like, I'm going out and I'm seeing the rest of the world, and, like, it was a good sort of reaffirmation for me as sort of, like, you know, hey, what I learned with a kid when I was a kid actually is true. It's even more true than I realized. Because obviously when I was a kid, I didn't understand the psychological, philosophical reasons behind all of these things. And now I understand it on a deeper level. But I really did have that experience. It's like, when I travel in the future, it's going to be for very specific reasons, because there are very specific things I want to see. It's not just like, I need to engage with this world culture. I have no desire, even though I'm Polish, I have no desire ever to go back to that region of the world. I want to go to Italy as an Italian and to see the architecture and the art. But that region of the world, Eastern Central Europe, fuck that place. I have no desire to ever go back there.
Wow.
You're here.
God, that's kind of sad. You took this whole vacation and that's like your main takeaway. That's,
well, I mean, I'm not talking about like any of my personal experiences and everything. Like, those things I don't feel like are appropriate to talk about right now. I'm talking about this more and something that I think is appropriate for the show.
Sure.
The whole point of travel is to go out there and learn about the way the rest of the world is and why it is that way, so you can have a better life yourself. You know, now I know the mistakes these people have gone through and suffered.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's like Daniel said, right? Like, you can understand intellectually the horrors of the Holocaust, but let me tell you, and I don't just mean going to Auschwitz and you go through and you see all the hair. Did you know the Nazis made them shave all their hair and they kept the hair? They kept the hair. So there's a whole room in Auschwitz with all the hair. And then you go through another room and there's all their glasses. And then you go through another room and there's all their, like, crutches and things like that. To know it intellectually and to witness that directly at Auschwitz, and not only that, but to witness the way it has affected these countries and the way they live on a daily basis, when you can't go through any country without seeing the effects of the Nazis and being reminded of that, and seeing the effects of Stalin and the communists and being reminded of that. Again, like I said, in America, the privilege we sort of have is we don't have any memories of that. We don't walk around and see that. That's terrible. So that's the value of traveling, is to see that and say, hey, you know, how good do I have it? And what is the real way of living in a positive, healthy way? To me, that's the value of it. So I don't think it's a sad thing to come away from that. And don't get me wrong, there's beauty within that. The way these people have overcome and they're trying to figure it out, and the pride they have in themselves and their countries. Like, yeah, collectivism is bad, but where's the discussion of where nationalism is bad? Right? I mean, to a certain extent, the fact that these people survived and learned and are trying to get better and have still made great art and have this architecture that they celebrate, and they've spent the money to, you know, Berlin is a largely rebuilt city. All the classical architecture, they're rebuilding that because they, you know, they see that as a value. So the fact that there is this flourishing and they're trying is great. It's just that I was born in America and I came back to America, and I can't escape that sort of point of view. So James, I get what you're saying, but at the same time, it's a positive and wonderful thing. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm fine here. I've got books.
You've got books. You can go to Hawaii. You can go to Disney World.
Yeah, I'm good. If I want to get exotic, I can go to Canada.
All right. No final thoughts? We want to just sum up this episode?
I think we should. Yeah.
All right. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
Well, I didn't learn how terrible Europe is, because I've pretty well known that for a while. But it's good to have that confirmed both by my wife and then by Justin. So, but what else did I learn? I learned that, what is the news that we did? It seems so long ago. I learned that that American students are an atrocity, and they're going to make us into Europe because of how unprincipled of thinkers they are. End rant.
James?
I guess I learned the extent of Europe's shittiness. I'd always heard people say things like, they say, I was glad to go there, but I was also glad to come back. That's the strongest I had ever heard it said.
Well, to be fair, keep in mind that I have
some of those details.
Keep in mind that I have stronger reactions than everyone else. I speak with a lot of passion, so
yeah.
On everything.
Yeah, but you gave details I had no idea of, I had some idea, but I didn't know of all those details you provided.
You want a couple other details?
Sure.
It's fucking freezing outside the whole time I'm there. It even snowed in Berlin. But it didn't matter what hotel room I was in, it was impossible to cool it down. Even opening the window to let the cold air in, it would still somehow make the room hotter. So I don't know how they do that. And then they have this other thing called positive housekeeping. I swear to fucking God to you, they give you basically face cloths for towels. Like, the number one thing, I got back and I showered at my girlfriend's house, and I was like, you know what? I'm so glad to be back in America because I can use a big fluffy towel to dry off. But with this positive housekeeping, they say, if you want to reuse your towel, hang it up. If you don't want to reuse it, leave it on the ground. But we would appreciate it if you reused your towel because we want to practice positive housekeeping. As millions of hotels every day use millions of whatever, I don't know, what do they use, liters? What do they use in Europe? I don't even fucking remember. Of
metric tons.
Metric tons of detergent every day. And that is harmful to the environment. So, to practice positive housekeeping, please reuse your towel during your stay. First of all, fuck you. I go to a hotel so I can have the luxury of having a wash towel every day because I don't have the time or the money to wash my towel every day. So fuck you on that. And fuck you, too, on trying to pass off a cost-saving thing on you, for you, on me saving the environment. You just don't want to wash towels every day because it saves time paying your housekeeping staff and it saves money on detergent. And you're trying to pass it off as an environmental bullshit. Fuck you.
They're starting to do that in America, too.
That doesn't surprise me. That's what I saw. I saw this and I go, fuck, they don't have this in America yet. It's just... So there's more details for you.
Yeah, they do. I've been to a few places.
Yeah. That was one of Faiza's observations, too, Justin, is one of the reasons she's called France a third world country is things like they can't get their heating and cooling together.
Yes.
Like even in brand new buildings and stuff, like it's either insanely hot or insanely cold. And it's really only insanely cold if they don't have the heat on because there is no air conditioning anywhere.
Yep.
Like, they just don't do air conditioning, period. The end.
No, that's 100% what it is. There is no thermostat. You can just turn the heat down, and it's still... There's no turning on the air conditioning.
Right. It's just heat on or off. That's it. And then the other thing she despised with a dear, dear passion is that the faucets... There's two faucets. One of them is cold water, and one of them is hot water. But ne'er the two shall meet. Like, you either get all cold or all hot, and then you have to mix them yourself.
You get scalding hot, like...
Yes.
So you can wash your hands with cold water, or you can make yourself some tea, basically.
that's pretty much it.
Those are your two options.
Yes. And no elevators. She didn't experience elevators. Maybe some of the newer buildings, but, like, the Airbnb place they stayed at was a 7-story walk-up.
God. I mean, I was in China, and I was expecting there to be lower levels of amenities, and there were, but this sounds worse than what you're describing.
I've never been to either. I would bet so much money that Europe is way worse than China.
Yeah, China do want to go to Japan so I can see the difference and see how...
China and sort of the Asian area of the world has sort of at least embraced to some degree the westernization of things. Europe, while they sort of had it, stopped at a certain point and want no more. Like, they were done with luxury.
It's like,
you know,
a country of hipsters.
In 1790. Like, that's it.
But that's what I'm telling you. I mean,
AC power grid, that's good enough.
That's right.
It partially is they stopped, but it's partially they got the shit kicked out of them and were invaded for 2 centuries when we were advancing.
They just gave up.
I get that, but things like the air conditioning thing now, it's like a point of pride for them to not have air conditioning because it's good for the environment. It's like, go screw off. Like, I can't stand that kind of thinking. So, anyway, I assume that's what you learned this trip, Justin? Literally on this trip?
Yeah, you heard plenty about what I learned, so go ahead, just plug some shit real quick and let's get out of here.
Well, good. Glad you were along with us on this journey, both to Europe and through the farce. If you want to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or Google Play, we'd much appreciate that. Helps us raise in the ranks. Also, if you go to themidside.com/podcast, you can listen to all the previous episodes of this show, even the non-European ones, which is crazy. You can also listen to last week's episode where I was the host. Thank you. And you can buy a t-shirt at themidside.com/store, False Dichotomy Bro, classic logo tee, and the Hail Snyder shirt. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Love our libertarian friends. What else is there? There's patreon.com/themidside where you can choose to give us money every time we produce an episode. So even when Justin's on vacation, as long as we produce an episode, you agree to give us $1, $2, $3, whatever it is you can afford. And we also release Patreon exclusive content on that platform, including a review of Star Wars, The Last Jedi, and coming up, I believe, Justin, a review of Ready Player One, right?
Yeah, I'm a little behind seeing Ready Player One because I was out of the country, obviously, and I didn't really want to, like, waste my time. Although, in the long term, it would have been better for me to see that movie, but in the short term, I'm in a place I've never been in. I don't want to see a movie. So, yeah, after this week, or this week, I'm going to see it, and we'll hopefully get it up this week. And also, Patreon subscribers, I haven't posted the couple episodes that were posted while I was out of the country yet. So when this one goes up, the other two are going to go up as well. So don't like freak out and think I'm fucking you over. No, I didn't get a chance to post those.
Yes, alas. So thanks so much for our Patreon subscribers. If you can't afford that and you don't want to go over to iTunes and you don't have thumbs, you can type a review, whatever it is, tell a friend. Because really, this show grows when you personally tell people about the show. That is the best way to get new listeners. And if it's any indication, I've seen a lot of people comment that they're new listeners recently. So thank you for telling a friend. Continue to do so. When you have opportunities on the weekends or at work or after work or with your significant other, just, you know, drop a little mid-side in the conversation. It makes life a whole lot better. So thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time.
This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.